For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast.
We're not talking about Freedom Day here. Even at 80% vaccination, in order to protect our hospitals and allow our systems to keep working, we're going to have some other types of restrictions, as well as testing, tracing and isolation in place in order to open up and to go forward despite that 80% vaccination rate.
That voice has become very familiar over the past 6 months. It belongs to the Federal President of the Australian Medical Association, Dr. Omar Khorshid. Dr. Khorshid has been a fixture on national radio and television news bulletins, advocating and advising governments and the public as we navigate the COVID-19 pandemic. We caught up with him in Perth in the middle of a long day of Zoom meetings and committees. Do you think the hospital system as it is today will cope with the national strategy of opening up once we hit whatever vaccination target is the flavour of the week this week?
Yeah, our hospitals all have plans for dealing with COVID emergencies, but we've got to remember that our hospitals are always busy all the time. Without COVID, without flu, we've actually seen record ambulance ramping and lots of problems accessing hospitals, through the year this year. So it's hard to imagine how next year, when we're living with COVID, when we've got thousands of people contracting COVID, that our hospitals are going to be able to cope with any additional demand.
Do those hospitals, are they backed up by support, funding, resources that they're going to need?
We're not aware of detailed planning around how to prepare the hospitals for the 70 or 80% vaccination target when the country starts to open up. And in our mind, that means the federal government and the state governments putting in the money that is needed to cope with the additional actual demand, but also the additional costs of doing your normal business, the use of PPE, the loss of efficiency that we're already seeing in hospitals actually really slows them down. They're highly efficient places. Working, doing your normal jobs in a COVID environment is very different and much, much more expensive. Then we've got to think about staff. We're already short of staff. We haven't had our usual supply of overseas doctors, nurses, and other people that really bolster our health system. We're right now seeing hospitals right around public, private, and in community settings short of staff, doctors and nurses. And you can only imagine that's going to get worse if we're seeing staff furloughed due to exposure to COVID or because they've themselves gotten sick. The really important one is how do we actually change our processes to actually live in a COVID environment? We've got situations at the moment where a single event, whether it be a school getting an infection or a hospital, causes hundreds of health staff to be taken out of the workplace. You can't run hospitals like that, and certainly not when there's tens of thousands of cases occurring on a weekly basis around the country. So we need to work out, do we actually need to furlough staff who've been vaccinated? Do we actually just test them every day, for instance? How can we keep our system going whilst also dealing with COVID?
What's the AMA's view and your view on rapid antigen testing as a way of screening? Do you think that rapid antigen testing should be made more freely available to the public, for example, and in other settings other than doctors and hospitals?
So rapid antigen testing will have a place in our COVID response, particularly as we live with COVID. The big problem with rapid antigen tests is they're not as accurate. And right now, if you use them in somewhere like WA or Queensland, they're actually going to cause more harm than good. The false positives and the chance of false negatives means that they really have no place when you haven't got much COVID. But that's all different when actually there's a 20 or 30% chance before you do the test that someone could actually test positive. Suddenly, these tests become very useful, and we can see ways that they could be utilized in hospitals, for instance, or in other essential workplaces on a daily basis or maybe a twice weekly basis. And if the test misses you on one day, it'll pick you up the next time. And the consequence of a false negative isn't that bad, because there's actually a fair bit of COVID in the community. Now, of course, you then got to look at what happens with the results. Will, if these are available at a pharmacy for each individual to use, what will happen if it tests positive? Will people just hide the result? Will they go and get their PCR to confirm it? You know, we've got some concerns around that. But if a system's set up properly where employers do it or hospitals do it, and you have got a feedback mechanism so the government still knows how many cases are going around, so there's an obligation to get a confirmatory PCR test once the test comes back positive, and an understanding that a negative test doesn't prove that you're negative. It's just a screening test. Yeah. I think once we get those things in place, there will be a really important role for rapid antigen tests in Australia.
The Doherty clarified something via tweet this week about their modelling, and basically saying that if we hit 70 or 80% vaccination and start opening up, they would expect there to be just under 400,000 cases, symptomatic cases, with 1,450 odd deaths over the next 6 months. Do you think that the strategy to open up gradually, regardless of case numbers, is a good one, or is it something that we need to rethink?
I think it's important to remember that with Delta, if you've got any COVID in the community, you'll very rapidly have thousands of cases or tens of thousands of cases, unless you've got very heavy social distancing restrictions in place.
Yes.
So it actually doesn't really matter whether you start from 30 cases, from 5 cases, or from 1,000 cases. You'll very quickly get into the thousands anyway. But what is important is that you've hit those vaccination targets. That is what will determine how many people end up in hospital. But we also need to be realistic with the population. We're not talking about Freedom Day here.
No.
Even at 80% vaccination, in order to protect our hospitals and allow our systems to keep working, we're going to have some other types of restrictions, as well as testing, tracing and isolation in place in order to open up and to go forward despite that 80% vaccination rate.
How's the relationship with the federal government and the AMA? Are they seeking your advice? Are they listening?
Well, the AMA is never backwards in coming forward with advice, and that's certainly been the case during the pandemic. We've got a very good working relationship with the Minister and the Department of Health, and I'm in regular contact with the Prime Minister as well. Now, they don't always take our advice, and sometimes we have to push fairly hard. At the end of the day, I am of the view that the government are trying to do the right thing. They do look at issues through their own lens, which is often different to the lens through which doctors look at the same issues. But at the end of the day, we are getting a good hearing, and a lot of our suggestions are being taken up by government after a little bit of pushing from us.
I'm chatting with Dr. Omar Khorshid, the Federal President of the Australian Medical Association. The AMA, of course, is the owner of the Medical Journal of Australia. Subscribing to the MJA costs $236 for 12 months of full 24/7 online access, including all articles on mja.com.au and all our online archives. Institutional and student subscriptions are also available. Find out more at mja.com.au/subscribe. If you're enjoying this podcast, you will find all our previous episodes at mja.com.au/podcasts. And you can subscribe to our feed on Spotify or Apple Podcasts so you never miss an upcoming show. Back to our chat. The hot topic of the moment appears to be children, what Delta variant does to children and whether vaccination is an option. The AMA's WA president was fairly strong on this recently, saying that it was akin to child abuse to open up before they were vaccinated. Do you agree with that view?
So we understand that people are really worried about their children, and they see the hundreds of thousands of children being infected around the world, and it makes them afraid, and I share that fear. But at the end of the day, it is worth remembering that COVID has a vastly lower impact on children than it does on adults, and particularly on older adults. And although the numbers of children getting infected is very high, the numbers that are actually getting sick are still very small around the world. Mm-hmm. And we can expect the same would occur in Australia. Now, if we had a vaccine that was proven to be safe and effective and was licensed, then of course we should roll it out to children before we expose them to COVID. But at the end of the day, we have COVID in Australia. It is here in New South Wales. It is here in Victoria. And it's not a matter of being able to wait. It's really a balance between lockdown, which of course has lots of negative impacts on children as well, versus exposing them to a virus that could make a very small number of them very sick. That's going to be a tough decision, but we are hoping that the data will come out of America and that we'll see a licensed vaccine for younger children available in Australia before the end of the year. And then hopefully we will be able to offer the vaccine to children before too many of them are exposed to COVID.
What do you think life will look like in Australia in, say, a year's time?
I don't think our life is going back to normal anytime soon. What I would see is Australia being like much of the rest of the world, trying as hard as possible to be as normal as possible, but having to live with the reality of this virus in the community, now endemic in the community, meaning the need to go into various levels of social distancing or restriction in order to keep a cap on numbers and to keep the hospital system working. A lot of impact on how we deliver medicine, you know, how a general practitioner sees patients, the use of telehealth, the ability to perform elective surgery, all of these things that we just take for granted, that are actually going to be quite difficult, I think, for the foreseeable future. Yeah. And it's a real challenge for us to set ourselves up with as much planning as possible to make sure that we can still live relatively normal lives and deliver relatively normal amounts of healthcare despite the pandemic. But that's going to be a real challenge.
Any regrets about running for president this year?
It's been a very different experience to what I was expecting, and having had the opportunity to watch many federal presidents over my time involvement with the AMA, it is totally different in my experience. However, we do have the opportunity to really make a difference in a way that the whole community can see. And, you know, it is therefore a privilege to be, I guess, at times the voice of our profession during a pandemic. But it does come with its negatives, with many, many Zoom meetings, the loss of all the fun stuff, you know, being able to go to international meetings and to run our own events and showcase what we are doing as an association and as a profession, and also just to prosecute an agenda on anything other than COVID. It's actually really hard.
I don't think it's any secret that membership of the AMA has been dropping over the years. Are you concerned about that? I think it's fair to say that well over half the country's doctors are not members of the AMA. Do you know why that is, and does it concern you?
Yeah, so we have been watching our fairly static membership numbers for a long time and wondering what we can do to improve that. And it is important that doctors join the AMA so that our voice is respected and listened to. So the numbers aren't going down, but the proportion of doctors who are members has decreased over the years as the numbers of doctors have increased. And we need to communicate our message and to ask doctors to actually to pay a membership fee for something that they get for free. And that's really been the difficult conversation, that the most valued thing about what the AMA does by doctors is our advocacy. We've asked that, and that's what we've been told. But you get that whether you're a member or not. And so for many doctors, they're happy for us to do what we're doing, but they don't feel the need to make a financial contribution. So we are looking at different ways of doing things, different ways of promoting our message, of communicating, but also making sure that we are relevant to not just the doctors of the now, but the doctors of the future. One silver lining from COVID has been the ability to actually start to spend some money on asking those questions, to get some consultants in. We haven't been flying doctors around the country to go to meetings, a lot of money on airline bills, and we're investing some of that in trying to set ourselves up for the future to make sure the AMA is more relevant and has more impact than what it's had in the past.
If you weren't talking about COVID-19 24 hours a day, what issues would you be focusing on?
Well, we are actually focusing on other issues. Mm-hmm. You're not seeing it in the media, but we're actually doing a lot of work on our broader agenda items. So those are around healthcare sustainability, around getting the government to invest properly in primary care, something that's been talked about for a long time, but we haven't seen the actual investment and the reform that's needed. We've had some wins in aged care, but there's more to be done there. We want more to be done on preventative care. And of course, we've got a public hospital campaign that's about to start up in the election environment, pointing out the need for our states and our federal government to invest properly in public hospital infrastructure, staffing and capability, because otherwise we're not going to have a system that can deliver the healthcare that Australians need into the future. We're also working on Medicare issues, on issues as detailed as the prostheses list, on private hospital reform, on trying to really turn the tide of managed care that seems to be washing over our private industry. Yeah. And remind all the decision makers of the importance of an independent medical profession in terms of delivering quality care to the public. So all those things are actually ongoing, and those are the things that we may not be talking about publicly quite as much, but we're still doing a lot of work behind the scenes and getting some wins.
Omar, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Okay, no worries. Cheers.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.